Hi, it's Lucy and welcome back to The Real Girls Club, my podcast where I interview women working in the film industry. For the first episode of season 3, I'm joined by Icelandic director and screenwriter Nina Palmadottir. Nina studied at the famous Tisch in New York and has now created several successful short films, such as Paperboy and All Dogs Die, and most recently her first feature, Solitude, which premiered at the Toronto Film Festival. In this chat, we talk about Nina's beginnings in Iceland, studying in New York, then touring her first feature around France, and now working as a teacher at the Icelandic Film School. Here is season 3, episode 1 of The Real Girls Club. Hi, Nina.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
You too.
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good.
I just want to quickly confirm first your name, if I'm pronouncing it right. Is it Nina or Nina?
It's closer to the first one, Nina.
Nina. Okay. And your second name?
Palmadottir.
Palmadottir. Okay.
Yeah, you got it.
Okay, good. Yay. I can basically move to Iceland now.
Yeah. Basically, you're ready.
Yes, I mean, I'm ready.
Happy like last name. So we have like a system with our last names where like dottir means the daughter of and son means the son of. So every last name, like most last names end with something dottir or something son.
Ah.
So my father's first name is Pálmi. So I'm the daughter of Pálmi. So I'm Palmadottir.
That's lovely. I mean, I really like that. It's funny that you say that because I was watching England against, oh God, I'm going to forget the team they were playing against. I think it was Serbia or something for the Euro Cup. And I was wondering why all the players, their name ended in each, like Djokovic or something each, and I was like, really curious, like why are all their names ending like this? And I looked it up and it was similar to what you've just said. It was because it's all like the son of someone. I was like, that's really interesting.
Is it Serbia? I'm gonna have to ask. I have a very close friend from Serbia. I'm gonna have to ask
please
her.
Please don't check. I probably got the country wrong.
Yeah, my friend, her name is Emilia Gasic.
Anyway, I thought that was very interesting and you made me think of that. Anyway, thank you so much for wanting to be on the podcast and everything. I'm glad we finally found a moment to do it because I know it's been a little while in the making. And I just watched your film today, so talk about last minute. I'm quite a last minute person. Sometimes it works, sometimes it's not the best idea. But anyway, I watched your film and I loved it. I really, really enjoyed it. And yeah, I would love to talk about that a bit more later. But anyway, let's just get started. And I've got quite a lot of questions to ask you. I'd love to just sort of start by asking you about your background and your studies and how did growing up in Iceland shape your perspective on storytelling and filmmaking?
Yeah, I think so if I just talk first about how my living in Iceland shaped things, I'm still figuring that out. I think we're always kind of getting to know how our background, how our childhood, how our surroundings affect us when we tell stories. And sometimes it's hard to pinpoint what it is, but I do believe that it made me curious about visuals. I think we're very much lucky to have a very powerful and spectacular presence of this rural nature. Of course, it affects artists in Iceland. It would be silly to say it doesn't. And I feel very lucky that I grew up in a smaller town in the north and my family, you know, my parents took us around a lot, me and my sister, and we, you know, traveled around in the summertime. And I also have roots in the East Coast from smaller towns even. And so it was definitely a part of my upbringing to go see it, be curious about it. So it was very early that I was, you know, kind of a kid in the backseat of a car, just kind of like observing what was outside the window and taking it in. And it still kind of amazes me. And I don't want to ever get to a place where I take it for granted, you know, because you get used to seeing something amazing and then you travel somewhere else and you see a completely different type of landscape that maybe doesn't feel that spectacular to the locals there. And I'm like, whoa, it's so beautiful, all these fields and all the trees, because we don't have a lot of trees and forests in Iceland. So I think, it made me curious. It made me aware of how healing it can be and how it can make you feel completely different ways. And especially here, because we have these like extremes, right? So It can both feel so warm and so comforting, but at the same time, it can feel very overwhelming and harsh and kind of rough, you know? So it's like all kinds of things. I don't know if that makes sense, but
Do you mean in terms of the, because at first I thought you were describing the weather when you were saying it can be really, really warm, but are you talking more about the, like
the feeling of it?
Feeling.
It's not, absolutely not warm. I wouldn't say. No,
I was going to say it doesn't look like a warm country.
More in terms of comfort, you know, nostalgia, okay. Comfort. The mountains can both feel like they're hugging you, but at the same time also scare you. So it's like all kinds of kind of contrasts that it creates, and weather-wise as well. So the weather is extreme. We have like right now the south side of Iceland has woken up to this period of volcanic eruptions time that's going to be going on for like the next 100 years. So it's
wow.
Like it's just, yeah, it's an interesting place to grow up in, and I'm going to continue to always be kind of like curious about it.
Of course. And so that's where you are right now. I just wanted to quickly confirm because I forgot to ask that at the beginning, but that you're in Iceland currently, of course.
I'm in Iceland currently, so I'm currently living in Reykjavik. Well, the last year has been quite much on the road with the movie, but yeah, I have my base here right now. But Reykjavik is my second kind of, like, I didn't grow up here. I grew up in the north, but I moved here for university more than 10 years ago. Yeah, when I started uni. But in terms of background with film, I mean, it just, it's kind of a cliche. I like grew up next to a video rental store that I miss dearly.
Handy.
So it was just like, you know, half a minute away from my house. And, you know, there's a lot of love for movies and movie watching at my home and with my parents. And my dad is a big movie buff. And I would always get like some cash to rent movies all the time. So I was just watching a lot of them. And I, you know, when I got into my teenage years, I think I just started to get more curious about other films, like independent films, horror movies, like old movies, all kinds of movies. So, and I always knew that I wanted to be an artist in some way. I was in music, I liked acting, I was just in it all. And I think when I kind of realized how filmmaking can kind of like bring all of those elements together to tell a feeling or tell a story and kind of like express my daydreaming self in like the most exciting way to me, at least, I think that's kind of when I got obsessed with filmmaking. And that was like a long time ago. So when I was 17, I was like, yeah, I'm going to do this.
So from a pretty, pretty young age then. Just curious, is that video rental store still there? Because in the UK and rental video stores, I mean, they've been taken over by like Netflix and streaming, so they're not really a thing anymore, but I wish they would bring them back because I loved going to Blockbusters. It was just like a fun.
So much. It's not, unfortunately, I think they've all kind of expired over here. I think there were like a couple of the very old ones in Reykjavik still, but I do think now they're not here anymore. I think it's like, I think it's over, unfortunately.
Need to bring back video rental stores.
Yeah, I hope it goes full circle at some point.
I mean, like vinyls are very much like booming again, like record players. So maybe video rental will come back. I don't know. I still have DVDs and at home. Not everything's on streaming, but.
And I feel so privileged to be a millennial that I have these memories. It's just
even of a VHS tape, like that was still really special. Although, like, to be honest, the fact you like having to rewind back to the front of the tape to get to like the start of the film the next time you watch it, that was probably a bit annoying. But
that's so funny to me. You like watch a movie and it was the greatest thing you ever saw, and as soon as it was over, it's just like rewind and watch it again.
Literally. I can think of like many tapes that I did that with, mostly Titanic, which is a very embarrassing thing to admit, but I used to love Titanic.
No, there's no such thing as guilty pleasure. There's just
So how would you describe the film industry in Iceland then? Did you find that you found a lot of opportunities there, or was it more kind of challenging? And is that why you moved to go and do your studies in America?
I mean, I think for me, I always had this dream of studying in the States. It started out as just kind of like a daydreamer, kind of
over like ambitious kind of vibe when I was a teenager. I was like, ah, if I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna go to the best film school, blah blah blah, you know. It's kind of but it's so funny how you can kind of like manifest things into action. And I think I needed to do a lot of work, hard work to get to that point. But I always kind of had this guiding light of like, I'm going to apply for these two schools in the States. And then it kind of was one of these things where like a dream came true, which is a very beautiful part of my life. I think for somebody that grows up in such an isolated place like Iceland, it is an island. It's a very small nation. I think, you know, my upbringing was lacking a lot of, like, it had a lot of beautiful, unique experiences, but absolutely was lacking an experience of, like, the outer world in a way. Yeah. So I think it's absolutely very good for an artist that grows up in a place like that to go somewhere completely different. And I think being in a class that was very international, to see all these different types of stories from around the world. Also, New York City is, like, just kind of like a hot pot of like culture and diversity, and I think it was just really good for me, both in a sense of for me as a storyteller, but also just for adulthood.
Yeah, I mean, I've never been to Iceland or New York for that matter, but from what I know about them, yeah, they are very different places. And I can imagine that, you know, going to New York must have been very much like, not going into the deep end, but like a complete culture shock probably.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I think I benefited from feeling very much so in a bubble of my school, and kind of like it got very busy very fast, and it feels good, you know, when you move to a different place to have a community already is really good. But it was absolutely a lot of things I had to get used to that I have no experience with. And yeah, I appreciate things like from both ends. There are things that I realized how much I adored about Iceland that I missed, but also I'm like a weird hybrid of like a countryside girl and a city girl. It's kind of a weird mix.
I think I'm the same. I need a bit of both.
So
how long were you in New York for then?
It was a 3-year program in school. The fourth year was for the purposes of finishing your thesis. I was lucky that it wasn't until in my fourth year when I was about to graduate that COVID hit. So I was fortunate that I had finished all my in school time, but COVID absolutely, you know, was one of the reasons why I was back home, as for probably a lot of people. But at the same time, it just kind of part of this timeline that, you know, was apparently very meant to be. I don't know. It's a lot of like, I'm like a person that really believes and just trust the process. And like, if you're planting your seeds and trying to do well, like, it's going to lead you to somewhere. And I think with Solitude, I had my short film Paperboy out around this time that did very well at home. So that was a good kind of introduction back into the industry in Iceland. And I met like a wonderful producer, Lilia, who saw Paperboy and wanted to collaborate on my first thing. Mm-hmm. But at that time, also by coincidence, Rúnar Rúnarsson, the writer of Solitude, he saw Paperboy when it was because it was nominated for the Icelandic Academy Award, and it actually won that award, which was very exciting for someone who was at school, like back to her home country. It was really an exciting time. But he saw Paperboy, and I saw this likeliness, what is the word, like similarities between this script that he had with Paperboy. That was a complete coincidence because we had never spoken about that, barely knew each other. So and somehow he had written this script that felt like the main characters of both my shorts had come into a feature. And wow. The best to my knowledge, he had wanted to, like, for the first time, to hand over a screenplay to another director. And he and Lilia were already collaborators, so it's just meant to be. So everything kind of just...
Yeah, you were planting the seeds somehow. It must have, it was meant to be.
No, it's absolutely insane to me when I think about the big picture, when you get like perspective later on, that somehow from like my own life experience, this idea came about for Paperboy, and that led to this. I would have never believed that.
I know, like, it's funny how life works out like that, and considering you're both from the same country and it's crazy, but you'd never met though at the same time. Loads of questions were coming into my head as you were speaking there. I do want to go on to solitude, of course, a bit more later. Yeah. Although I'm curious, because you were saying that it was quite well received in Iceland, for example, for your short film Paperboy, or it was very well received because you won the prize. But I thought I read somewhere that you said that the film is received differently in Iceland and, you know, maybe in, I don't know, America or the UK. Like, do you feel like sometimes people from your home country don't fully understand your filmmaking?
Well, I think that's super interesting because I think, you know, sometimes with movies, like, humor, mannerism, tone is perceived differently in the place where it's from. I think it's been super interesting to travel with it and see how different audiences from different parts of the world connect to it, what they're curious about. And I think, I mean, of course, I understand that, you know, a little film from Iceland maybe feels bigger to, like, somebody from a completely different place. To be honest, it's really hard for me to tell because I think it's hard for me to, like, kind of analyze my own film and, like, how people see it.
Yeah, because you're very much, like, in it. It's hard to take, like, that kind of outsider perspective that everyone else is having.
It's quite hard to get perspective when you're the director because, yeah. And for the most part, I've just kind of, I'm happy about kind of my background and my studies at Finnish because I feel I was mentally prepared for the ride it has been to release something that then becomes the audience's and not yours anymore. And I think you're always going to have people that it just hits their heart and that's wonderful. And then you're going to have a different response. You know, not everybody's going to connect to it, but then you just have to kind of, like, see what your perspective on it is, I guess. So I think nobody would survive this industry if they weren't able to, like, gain productive perspective about the reception of a movie. Mm. And I think, yeah, it's been a really great lesson, just what I take with me moving forward, how I'm able to maybe, like, if somebody has a negative experience about it, how I'm able to move forward from that, you know, take it in and then release it, you know, mm-hmm. and not let it take my spirit away of, like, making more stuff. It's really hard. I mean, so I'm happy that Tish really, we really did a lot of, like, critique. We were in a good way forced to listen without speaking about reception and critique of our shorts. So,
but then built some thick skin.
Yeah, but, like, it's still okay to feel all those emotions. It's, yeah, like, very normal, very vulnerable, you know, process and experience to release a movie. And I've never, it was my debut, so I've never, like, on this scale to be in a theater where it wasn't, like, one of five or six shorts. It was just people were there to see that one thing, and that felt really crazy to me. You can definitely put, like, a lot of pressure on yourself as well if you're prone to that.
But yeah, you're very much putting yourself out there. So even if you can be like, okay, everyone can have their opinion, or you can take some constructive criticism, of course, it's still going to be a bit like, oh, that hurts a bit because, you know, that comes from, like, you know, inside.
Yeah, but that's okay. It just means that it matters to you. And, you know, and then it's about, what am I going to do with that? You know, am I going to make it doubt myself or, like, not try things and not go for these things? And I hope, I've been asking people, I hope it gets easier, you know, for, like, it's just the whole kind of stress with showing your movie. What I was gonna say, oh yeah, and then there are these moments, you know, in these, like, really small screenings, you know, where this one person says something. You know, we had this screening in France, and there was, like, a screening that was, like, relatively small compared to others. And then there was this one man that just said, I don't know a lot about movies, but I just know that this movie made me feel something. Oh. And that was beautiful. Like, it was so simple. And honestly, that was more, like, precious than anything.
Yeah.
And it can take just one person like that somewhere in the world, where you're like, oh yeah, I tried something, I did something, I was vulnerable with it, and hopefully somebody will have this. It will make them feel something. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah, definitely. You make, even if it's just, like, that one connection with someone, I think it's almost sometimes enough. Like, you have to hold on to that for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's been very rewarding, and I've learned a lot.
Yeah. I saw that it was being shown in a cinema not too far for me in like my nearest sort of city, but I couldn't make it. And I was like, oh my God, this is the only time I'm going to get a chance to see it. And I need to see it for this interview. But luckily you were very kind and sent me a link. But yeah, I was like, wow, it's showing in the cinema near me. But it was showing in like, in French you call it Art Essai, like a kind of independent art cinema.
Yeah.
But I think that's really nice that you, of course, you know, made a kind of global, well, I don't know how far it's gone, but of course it's come to France, the UK, and then maybe you know whether it's going to go even further after that.
Yeah, it's the first time where I've just put my faith in wonderful people that know what they're doing in terms of distribution and sales. Mm-hmm. Very, very great hands with Party Film Sales and Show de Beth. And yeah, France was surreal. I mean, I did a little Q&A tour with it in the springtime, which was really lovely. But to me, it wasn't until we had our kind of pre-premiere screening in Paris where I stood there and I was like, if I could tell my 14-year-old self that is obsessed with movies that I'll be in France to show my film, she would be like,
wow.
No. Which is like nice to, sometimes it's just nice to show yourself some grace and just, you know, kind of pat your little self on the back for
definitely you've got to like stand back and be like, wow, I did that. I just want to talk a little bit back in the past, a little tiny bit, but I saw that you've also been a production assistant and you're a gaffer as well, and you've even worked on Game of Thrones, but that was mostly obviously when it was on location in Iceland, is that correct?
Yeah, research is correct.
Yeah, good. Well, I mean, it was on IMDb, so if wrong on there, then that's not good for them. But yeah, I noticed you did all of this. So, and before your short films, what were all these experiences like? And because obviously that wasn't quite in directing yet. So what did these experiences bring you? And did you sort of realize, nah, this part's not for me. Like, I don't want to do production or gaffer, for example.
No, I think I would never want to get to a place where, you know, all of these links on a film set are so important. And I think what I'm mostly grateful for those years of working as a PA, for example, was just this introduction to what makes a set work. Also just to get like to be from Iceland and to get like a glimpse into the bigger productions like that was very exciting for like a 20-year-old that wanted to be a filmmaker. Very hard as well. I think it absolutely gave me thicker skin to like, it takes a lot more for me to, you know, get upset about anything. It's just, you know, and I think it was a really great preparation for then going to film school and focus on directing, because I do think it benefits a director to understand what you're asking people for, like what it requires of your departments, what you're asking for. Also just to understand that it's people first and then the project. And I think it just gave me like a really valuable insight into how a set works and functions, how the work you have to put into it, how much of a hard work it is to create a thing. It was just a lot of fun, to be honest. Very hard as well. I think, you know, very valuable lessons. So I always, you know, I'm teaching directing right now, like on and off. I really love teaching, and I always encourage my students to try and a couple of summers to get out there and try working as an assistant or a runner or something, but it's gonna like really help them understand
where is it that you're teaching?
The Icelandic Film School.
Wow.
But yeah, no, this is a, you know, our oldest film school institution. Now it's exciting times because we have like a couple of places now. We also have like a very newly founded film department in the Icelandic Art School. So it's a couple of places. But for the last maybe 3 years, I've been teaching like on and off courses at the Icelandic Film School. And it's, yeah, I didn't know how much I would love teaching. I really love it.
Amazing. What an honor as well. Like, you've kind of really come full circle, you know, gone from your home country, traveled away, made your own film. And were you asked, or was it something you applied for at the school?
I think I met myself. I was like, I should teach here. Hire me.
Good. Like total belief in yourself. That's amazing.
So, I knew that I wanted the experience. I wanted to see if it was something I loved. And it's still, I mean, you have like a bunch of imposter syndrome when you start to teach. I felt I went to the room just like, I promise I'm your teacher. So it came with a little bit of a, you know, also, yeah, I think you have to have like some sort of a humbleness that you're also learning still. And I would never want to get to a place, both as a teacher and as a filmmaker, where I had nothing more to learn. So I think, yeah, it's been really rewarding to teach. So
yeah, and even like the massive directors, you know, they do like master classes and probably even give university classes as well in some parts of the world. And it's a great idea really to give back, isn't it? And you know, you don't want to focus all the time on making films because you never know what when your next film might be, maybe, or what will happen. So it's great to have another sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? Not like a path, but another kind of channel, I guess, like for your passions as well. And, you know, you're giving back to other people that will be, you know, maybe future filmmakers of tomorrow.
Yeah, it's honestly, it's so like, it wasn't until like my first, like my when my first year class graduated, and I went to the screening of their graduation films, and I was just like, oh my God, this feeling is like nothing else, to be so proud of your students. It's like really, aww, it was a really beautiful feeling. And I was like, yeah, I wanna do this as much as I can. But yeah, I wanna, you know, in a perfect world, it's like a harmony of like you do your own thing and then and you're able to do this as well. So
So I mean, you're, you know, a teacher now, like you're saying, but did you have any strong like mentors throughout your studies, maybe at New York or at school in Iceland, or just in your, what's the word, entourage or whatever, like was there anyone that was like your core mentor throughout your sort of career and still now maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been really thankful and appreciative of people that have kind of like encouraged me from the get-go. And it's just like a mix of like mentors, just people that encourage you and believe in you and help you. And I think I really keep them close to my heart throughout. So, and then also, of course, like teachers as well. So I had my thesis advisor, my writing teacher, Mick Casal, like from Tisch, like I really, he's just one of those teachers that sees their students for what their voice is and encourages them to stay true to that and not like change for anything. And I really appreciate that. Yeah, like a few teachers at Tisch. Then there's this the filmmaker that gave me my first job opportunity in Iceland. He's from the same part of Iceland. His name is Baldvin Seta, is what he's Baldvin Sofonjason, and he's made a few movies. He's just like a really wonderful person, and he gave me my first PA job when I was 19 years old, and has always given me great advice ever since. So another friend that I met like on one of these sets. So when I was in, I think, Walter Mitty or Game of Thrones or something, one of the DITs became a friend of mine, and I would always, he's just the kindest person ever, and I would always like make it my business to bring him coffee and, and like take care of him as much as I could. And later on, you know, he now has his own production company, and he helped a lot with Paperboy, and we're really lovely friends. So who is his name? Yeah, a few shout outs here and there. So it's a mix of things. And then my parents, you know, they're also my life mentors,
yeah,
right?
Definitely. And you said your dad is a big film buff too.
He is, and he's a musician and an artist. And I think like both of my parents have you know, overcome so many things in their lives, and are just my best friends and people that I really look up to. So
I have that in common. My dad also is like quite a big film buff, and so yeah, he introduced me to quite a lot of films really, or more like I kind of just raided his DVD collection eventually. That's really nice. Of course, I love talking about all the positive things, but what kind of challenges have you had and how have you overcome them? Like any points where you're just like, I don't know if I want to continue with this, or was there never really like any doubt in your mind?
I think what's helped me the most is to trust that it will all go as it's supposed to. That's been like a big thing with things that maybe were difficult in pre-production, during shooting, in the aftermath, you know, what festivals will it show? All those things, it's really helped me to kind of just let go and know that if I put my most kind of sincere self, I've done my best, it will all kind of go as it should. And that later on, I will know why. That's like, that helps me a lot in situations that I can't really control. And another thing is just to trust other people. I think, and I bring that forward, you know, when you have a team of, you know, producers and you've chosen your collaborators that are fellow artists, it is to trust them.
Yeah, you know, trust that they know what they're doing.
Yeah, yeah, and trust them with what they do best and trust your production team. And that was something I had to remind myself, because before that, I've just done shorts where I was the co-producer and I had to do so many things myself with, like, also great help from collaborators. But I think it was a lot about letting go and, you know, just trust other people.
Mm.
With, like, the directing job, I think there's such a big difference between fighting for something you believe is right for the vision, you know, yeah, and making those choices, but also keeping an open mind to maybe you don't know what it needs. Maybe you have to have other people show you as well.
Mm. No, definitely, yeah, other people's opinions or perspectives.
Yeah, and it's just collaboration, isn't it? So I think that was very good for me, because of course it was like a big deal. It was my first directed movie, like feature movie, and you know, it was a lot of anxious moments, but I really just put my trust into the team as well and the actors, and just also that you don't always have to know the answer right away. That's mm-hmm. like, that was a nice advice that I got from Runar, the writer, like the weekend before we started shooting. We met for a coffee and he gave me some like good last minute advice, you know, from somebody that had made movies.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, you know, it's like, you don't always need to know the answer right away. Sometimes it's okay not to know and just figure it out, step aside, just figure it out and with your people. And yeah, I think that's something I also want to take with me, is that, you know, it's a process where you don't always have to know.
Mm.
And you doubt, it will be okay. But it's a nice advice to give out to, like, up and coming and young directors, where they feel they're gonna enter their sets and feel like imposters. Hopefully not. It's like a really bad feeling that you shouldn't feel. But I think it's gonna take a lot of pressure off yourself if you just, you know, don't feel like you need to put on a hat of knowing everything all the time, because it's not possible. We're all just trying to do our best, aren't we?
It's funny because you're not the first person I've interviewed to talk about imposter syndrome, although I think it's something people didn't really talk about so much, I guess, and then it kind of came into the language of, like, the internet, I guess, and then a lot of people were talking about having it in the workplace. I'm sure it's not just unique to women, but it does seem like other directors, male directors, like, I feel like they come on, I mean, this is just maybe my opinion, but they seem to, like, have just a lot of natural confidence and almost, like, certainty, like, maybe imposter syndrome is still a thing for them, though.
I think it's a word that describes when people feel like they're not worthy, which is a very sad fact. But, you know, in this day and age, I think we put a lot of pressure on ourselves, a lot of, like, career and success pressure. And I think it's a very human thing to feel, but it's something that's, I think, and it's a work in progress for sure. I think even, you know, when I was on the stage at TIFF with the movie, you know, I was like, why am I here?
But I know, whereas the moment should have just been enough confirmation for you to be like, well, I'm here. So
yeah.
The place is deserved.
A really, really important thing to work on. And you know, it's gonna be ups and downs, but I think it's like the most cruel thing you can do to yourself is feel like you're not worthy of the good things in your life.
Yeah, of course. And like, you've really got to be that person to believe in you before anyone else anyway. Your self-esteem can't come from other people, kind of thing. So it really has to be in yourself already. So yeah, I want to go on and talk about Solitude now. So I watched it today and I really, really enjoyed it. Even though it was a quiet film, you know, there's not loads of dialogue. Mm. The main character, Gunnar, is not the most talkative person. In fact, he kind of reminded me of Travis from Paris, Texas. Just this, like, this guy that's come out of nowhere and you don't know his past really. He's just very quiet and you're like, where's this guy come from? Like, and why is he this way, you know? But I didn't feel like the pace was like, oh God, like, when's this going to end kind of thing. It wasn't like that. It was just a really nice pace. Although the film's not really that long. It's only an hour and 16 minutes or so. So it's quite a short film for a feature length, but still very much a feature length. So, I mean, yeah, you didn't write the script, but I'm going to pronounce his name wrong. So it's better you say it for me. But yes, someone else wrote the script. So you've already spoke about that a little bit, but like, why did he not want to film it? And how did that come about?
Yeah, it's, I mean, I can't speak for Runar, what his process was. I think he is an amazing writer, and I think he has a lot of stories under his belt. And I think it was just one of those movies that he hadn't made. And I mean, the best to my knowledge, I think it was just like a career step to have somebody like to be a writer, but not the director, which is probably like very hard as well from his side to let go of the creative process of his writing.
Yeah.
You know, I was just highly like really grateful for that he saw this opportunity, because, you know, he saw the short, he saw that we were kind of dabbling with the same world of characters, of feeling. We're not the same filmmakers. You know, it would be completely two different films. And that's always the case with, you know, directors. You know, you can have the same script, two directors, and they're not going to make the same film. For me, it came as a surprise for me how this came about. I mean, I'm a writer as well, and I always figured that my debut would be my writing directing. But to be honest, after I sat with the script, I saw that it was just this incredible opportunity to have a beautiful story, to do this for the first time, to make the story my own and kind of figure out how I like to tell stories. And yeah, and also with how much it was meant to be in terms of like plot and these characters, it was just something I had to do, and I'm so grateful that I did it. What else? Oh, you mentioned, I love that you mentioned Paris, Texas, because we watched that, like in preparation, we watched it. And actually one of our, with my costume designer, Artis, like one of our, the look with the baseball cap and the suit, like,
yeah,
really much
like yeah, very similar actually. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it was absolutely like in the thought process, like how like also we wanted to like make kind of his appearance like not the typical, because not every farmer in Iceland wears a wool sweater. That's like, you know, we have our traditional Icelandic wool sweater and what you would think a farmer would wear, but we wanted to make our own character with Gunnar and like how he dresses. And I just really loved, it was one of our favorite bits was this, that he puts on his like only suit when he goes to the bank, and but also has a baseball cap, which I love that it has the similarity to Paris, Texas and that kind of character. So I love that connection you made.
Since it was somebody else's script, it's not exactly like an adaptation when you've got a book and then you adapt it. But did you adapt his script in any way and like change things around? Was he very much on set with you as well when you were doing it, so he could be like, well, no, I want to keep things like that, or full creative control, and you could do
it? No, he made it his business to completely step away, and he wanted to, he reminded me as well, because it's somebody, like Runar is somebody that I've looked up to for a long time, and I think it was so, I'm extremely grateful that when we got into pre-pro and those decision makings and the shooting, that he was available to be supportive, but he really just said, it's your film, you know, I'm gonna step away. So it was and that was really, I mean, I really needed that to make it my own. In terms of like the script, it wasn't necessarily rewritten in any way. There wasn't like, there was like a fine tuning of the focus, you know, the focus that I decided to make in the execution of it. But that's pretty standard when you take on a script, is to maneuver a few things, but also just to have this kind of blessing and the space to create more moments as we went. So in the pre-pro and rehearsals with the actors, there's so many things that can happen when you, especially when you have a film that's really character driven and it has to do with like an organic connection between characters. I think it's so great to create this space of what can happen here? Like what can happen in the scene? Is there like a moment that could just organically happen, you know? So there are like a few moments in the story that were added as we went along. So, and that came from, you know, for example, when they were banging on the table, like the scene where they were like drumming the table together, that was something they just started to do in between takes, you know? And I'm so grateful to have been taught in school to be observant on set, you know, not to be absolutely merged with your monitor and just be with your actors, you know, notice behavior, be curious about those little magic moments that could happen. And they started doing it, I was like, we have to create a moment of this. And it became one of my favorite scenes of their friendship. Yeah. So
I like the dancing scene as well.
Yeah, that also was added. So there's a lot of little, like, I'm very happy. I, like I said, I would never call it a rewrite. The story and the heart was there, but I was very thankful that Runar was okay with me putting my little moments and touch on it as we went along. So
that's nice.
That was good.
I mean, I thought Iceland looked just really beautiful. Did you incorporate like specific Icelandic elements into the film, like on purpose, that you felt like were really important to highlight?
The location scouting and the decisions in terms of the landscape was very much logistical, to be honest, because we had to have elements that worked with the story. So with the whole body of water, the dam, the house, you know, we had to, like, where we found, we had to find the perfect farm. That took a while. We were kind of limited to like a part of the country that wasn't requiring us to have the whole crew accommodated in a different part. You know, it was a lot of elements that also was a big lesson for me. Like, it's hard to location scout. It's so important. But we found the perfect house in the end, but we had to kind of have it close to a body of water, but then we had to fake the body of water, which was actually the ocean, and then we had to find the lake to emerge the car and the CGI the house, which had like a similar background to where the house. It was like a whole puzzle of elements that I'm very happy that it worked in the end.
It's a lot to work out.
Yeah,
kind of like a maths equation or a puzzle, like that you've got to be like, how is this going to work, and then somehow it does.
But I would never want to use, like, that's another thing. I think it's very easy to use Icelandic nature and the spectacularness of it as a token visual element. And I think I've always wanted it to serve a purpose story-wise. Like, why do you have this white shot of mountains? Like, what does it have to do with your character? Where is the character in the frame? So, like, for me, I think I love the journey, the car ride journey from the countryside to the city, and just to be in that moment and feel that contrast of leaving one world for another. And that's like a big thing. Like, I think why we're always talking about like city country a lot in Iceland is because there is a big contrast. Like, we're in this like little cozy city, and as soon as you leave the outskirts of it, you're in the wilderness, you know. And for me, it was more so of a Reykjavik story than an Icelandic countryside story, you know what I mean? Okay. It's like, it was more about letting go personally for this man. Yeah. It's tricky, but I think that's what I can comment about it.
Yeah. I mean, I thought, it was again making the Paris, Texas comparison, but he's very much like gone from like the desert to then going back into, I guess, like society again after being, you know, wherever he's been. And it's the same for Gunnar. Like, he seemed very at home in the countryside with his horses and his farm, and he was more than happy to stay there. You know, he didn't care about the money, really. He was, you know, that was what he loved probably, and he felt so comfortable there. And then it was a mixture of like discovering the city, but also like he sometimes looked out of place. Yeah. For me, I felt like he didn't look right there or something, like he didn't fit in the landscape. But then he kind of slowly growed into it, like he said, you know, the boy helped him bring life to the house and things like that when he was writing his letter to the cousins.
It's kind of a coming of age for them both, and I always wanted to kind of, even if he's like a different generation, an older generation, it always I wanted him to almost feel like a child sometimes, like how he was kind of discovering his world and his kind of curiosity about his surroundings. And you know, it's a coming of age story for him as well, because it's the first time he's taking these steps in life. So
I felt very much though, like, I don't know, because it was so heartwarming to see them getting along so well, and then so for the sort of twist to happen and what sort of tore them apart was like, oh, I thought that was quite crushing. Like, I wasn't waiting for a happy ending, because it's not always like the Hollywood happy ending. But I don't know. It was kind of, it was quite ambiguous. Like, I was like, I don't know where he goes, because, like, you know, he's having that daydreaming in a way, looking out the window. And then he snaps out of it, and it's not actually what's happening. So I was like, oh, wonder what happens next. But I guess there's no solitude too. So
I think, I people have, you know, perceived this kind of, well, I wouldn't call it like a plot twist. It's something that's probably crossed your minds like multiple times while watching the film. And I think it's of our expectations in society is this kind of like suspicion. This position that people aren't good, and I it's supposed to feel like shit, you know, it's supposed to feel awful, and because you care about this friendship and you care about these characters, but you know, it's kind of like back to reality kind of thing, like how the world kind of catches up with these two very sincere, innocent beings, and how it kind of moves Gunnar's journey forward into letting go of certain things and, you know, finding peace within himself. And even if it's like a really hard way how he gets there, I wanted to give the audience like a bit of a hope in the end, and I hope that came across. It was like a little smile on his face before he exited the frame.
Yeah,
and
true.
I think, you know, and also because our execution, me and my editor's execution of that ending wasn't written originally. So that's another beautiful thing about collaboration and my, you know, my friend Eva, who edited the movie, how it can become something you didn't know you wanted and can become completely bigger with somebody's input in the collaborative process. So he offered me a different ending that felt very scary in the moment, but then it made complete sense because it never felt quite right with me that it would be solved so easily with him just walking out and everything would be fine. It was always kind of written that he would exit the frame and we as an audience would be left in the window. But for me, it always felt more kind of internal, like an internal journey of like, I can be in charge of my own life. It will be okay, you know? So this wasn't the moment where it could all be solved. There were some hints that I tried to give the audience that the boy, inaudible, the boy probably came clean to his mom when Gunnar left, you know? And then just this little smile. And that's a performance thing as well. Just this subtle little smile that I hope would give a little hope in the end.
I did notice that, and I thought, also like him knowing inside that he didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, it always, with the whole lake scene and the water emerge scene, for me it was kind of like a rebirth for Gunnar. And I loved in our Q&As that people were even asking, is the horse real or not? And on the lakeside.
Ah, yeah.
When he came to kind of greet him after he went to the house and kind of said goodbye to his farm. So I loved that. That's what I loved about the Q&As and all, you know, how audiences perceive things differently is then some people found it quite fantastical. And I kind of love that element of what is in his head and what is real.
Yeah, I mean, there's loads of like little moments that I'd love to pop it. I've wrote down a few random things that I won't keep in the podcast, but maybe you can answer them for me. Just before we sort of wrap up, I mean, you're working on your next film and this time you have wrote it. So can you tell me a little bit about that if it's not too top secret?
Well, at the moment, I'm working on a treatment and outline for the actual script, and I think it's too soon to share, but I will say I'm very excited about it, and it feels probably the most personal thing that I've written. So
I'm excited about it as well.
it's English language, actually. I think I'm feeling quite ambitious to spread my wings out from Iceland. Well, in this case, it is an idea and a concept that is quite universal, so it doesn't feel like something that has to happen here. I will continue to make Icelandic movies, but the next one I think I'll venture into the English language realm. That's what I'm developing right now, and I'm just developing something for TV. And then just, you know, a director of hire, hopefully, you know, it's also, I'm quite excited about the TV scene right now. It's very diverse. It's very, I feel like it's grown so much in the last 10 years.
Definitely.
And it's a really exciting space to be a part of. So I would love to take those steps as well in the next coming years. So.
And you're teaching as well, of course. So plenty to do.
Sure.
Well, thank you so, so, so much for the conversation today. It was really, really nice. You're very inspiring and enthusiastic about what you do. And I really wish you all the best. And if I'm in Iceland, I would love you to show me around.
Oh, absolutely.
I've never been and it looks beautiful. Hopefully I can come one day. I will let you know.
I'm so glad we were able to do this. And I always wanted to do this. So I'm so glad we had this chat. It was really
me
good.
Too.
Whatever my accent may be, the state of it may be, but I love speaking in English every once in a while.
No, so. You speak perfect English, honestly. And it's always nice to have a little accent, but I don't feel like you've got a
flair of accent. Yeah. It's there. Thank you so much with everything.
Yes.
Thoughtful, interesting questions.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you very much. You'll be the first episode of season 3. Woo!
Yay! What an honor. That's awesome.
Have a nice evening.
You too. Bye.
Bye. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. It was a pleasure to be able to speak with Nina about her career journey, and I found her advice and stories very refreshing and just very insightful. So I hope you really enjoyed it too. I'll see you next month for another episode. Until then, you can follow @RealGirlsClub on Instagram for updates. Thanks so much for listening again, and have a lovely day.